We talk about voting with your wallet or spending for the future. And I think every time you make a conscious, hopefully conscious decision to spend with a business, that is your vote for the future. You're giving a stamp of approval to continue doing what they're doing.
Are you interested in carbon management solutions for individuals and small businesses? What do you think about the carbon elephant? How can we change the system we reside in? Stay tuned for answers from George Dry.
What is the future for cities? Do you want to learn more about them? Do you want to know how others think about them? Do you want to be part of the conversation? Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview George Dry, the Director of Business Development at Kogo. We will talk about his vision for the future of cities, resilience, responsible land and property management, bank involvement in sustainability, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. As the Director of Business Development at Kogo, George Dry provides carbon measurement and climate action solutions that help financial institutions throughout North America, Asia, and the Pacific to help their business and retail customers understand, measure, and reduce their impact on people and the planet. And with that, Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your time. I highly appreciate your appearance on the podcast. Let's jump right in. What does the future of cities mean to you?
I think the first place to start here for me is just livable. The future of our cities need to be livable, easy for all to live in such cities. And I think that starts with reducing the cost of living crisis that we're seeing all over the world. Cost of food, energy, housing, these things are all very hard right now for a lot of people. Fuel is going up. So I think the future of cities is livability for everyone to be able to live and afford in such cities. Then following on from that, a theme that will run through this conversation is climate resilience. You know, this is the core focus for me. This is where I believe our tax dollars and councils and government focus should be. I think jobs and money transition towards climate resilience is really important for the future of our cities. Following on from that, I would say they need to be equitable. I think we need everyone along on this journey, on this just transition. And similarly to livability, I think equitability, we need all people to have the ability to live in these cities. And for Aotearoa New Zealand, I think it's relevant to mention the future of cities. I think we should be honouring the treaty and a relinquishment of crown-owned land to iwi and tangata whenua, who by all accounts would do a lot better job of managing the land than what we're seeing today.
So the future of cities need to be livable, climate resilient, equitable, and honouring the original owners of the land. Interestingly, with livability or with everything, you haven't mentioned sustainability, green spaces, nature inclusion, and any other of these green terms. May I ask you why?
These are all very necessary pieces. I think livability and climate resilience are the cornerstones, the grounding foundation before we move into sustainable and green cities that are flourishing or thriving. If we're looking at what I believe is the basis of cities, we need them to be those things, climate resilient and livable. They need to be cheap on living, housing, food, transport, energy. Before we even started looking at green and sustainable and low emissions. So I think that foundation is what we need to focus on first, because moving a lot of people into a city that has very high percentage of renewable energy or good transport or nice green spaces, if you don't have those basics of affordable housing or climate resilience, is somewhat irrelevant. I think we need to get those foundations sorted first before we can start focusing on things that will make our cities, our people, well, natural habitats, our bird life flourish.
From your description of livability, it seems for me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that it's more about the economical side of living in the city to make it more affordable to include everyone. Not necessarily about finding there something, but allowing people to go there. Do I understand it correctly?
Yeah, I think I have had probably a strong economic lens to this. And my reference point is strongly New Zealand focused and looking at some of our major cities and seeing, again, the cost of all of these things going up. And I think the strong deterrence for living in such cities right now is economic, is the cost of these things. That to me seems, again, a foundational step to correct and to manage to then retain people in those cities and attract people to those cities before we even start on other areas.
Then I would love to understand, what do you mean by the city? What does the city mean to you?
I think for New Zealand, again, specifically, we have a few cities that could be classed as a city on a global stage. And I just don't think we do a city very well in this country. I grew up in Auckland, and it is a very hard place to live in regards to how sparse it is, transport, the congestion problems that we have. Early on this year, the start of this year, we had significant flooding throughout the city. So it is not resilient. Regardless of your length of that government, things were not managed well. It is becoming a tricky city to live in for all of these reasons. Fuel price again, energy and food, grocery. I've lived in Wellington and now currently reside in Christchurch. Christchurch is obviously on a rebuild and has a significant opportunity to become a better city than hopefully the rest of the country, but also than what it was. And I'd like to see, and I believe that Christchurch is moving forward in a different direction and not building back to where we were before and making some change for the benefit of its people. So I suppose I refer to these as cities in our country in regards to high metropolitan areas, a lot of commerce, a lot of high dense living. But then on a global scale, I've been lucky enough through work to travel to Singapore a few times. We attended a large banking conference in Las Vegas of all places. There's obviously a range of views on what a city looks like and does, but I think a lot of my reference point would be New Zealand and probably those three main cities I'd be referring to throughout this conversation. That are all different stages of growth and development and hopefully trying to attract these people to these cities as we continue to have a large influx of people coming into our country from overseas, and that will only continue through the next decades. And so I just want our cities to be able to manage those people and allow our existing residents to not be pushed out due to these economic reasons or climate reasons. And as we hopefully grow populations and densities, that we do it in a smart way and echo some of the better cities out there in the world that are making some nice progress to livable cities.
Do you have an example you look for as a good livable city?
It's a good question. I think in some cities I've seen doing some certain things well. I'd refer to the top of my mind, Copenhagen and Amsterdam in regards to cyclability of those cities. I love that cycling advocate, and I think a great thing for lower emissions and health and reduction of cars on the road that jumps to mind. Some cities are doing energy very well and having microgrids between residents and homes. Some cities with really high solar adoption, smart transport use, I think in green buildings. I think some of these cities definitely could be mirrored or echoed here. I don't know if I could put a finger on one city that was doing all of these things really well, but I think picking and choosing different examples of different areas from other cities and copying those would be a smart approach for countries on cities that are in the rebuild, Christchurch in New Zealand.
What does smartness mean to you?
I think making decisions with a range of information, range of credible information, and making decisions without any, as little bias as possible, as little external influence from ulterior motives, if I can say that. Making decisions with good information for the benefit of your people and the future in mind. No lobbying or with no external negative influences, I would say. And that's referring to smart decision forces in local governments and councils. And I think that look to overseas is really important as well, as I mentioned. looking at examples of cities that have done certain areas well, I think that would be a smart approach.
So you have been describing climate resilience, and resilience is very important for you. I assume it's partially because you live in Christchurch, and Christchurch had a few disasters in the last 10 years. Michael Haley talked about how people in Christchurch really show what resilience is throughout these 15 years, let's put it that way. And I would love to understand what this resilience means to you.
I was not here for the earthquakes. I'm a recent run in Christchurch coming from Wellington at the end of last year. And that was a decision I made for my now very young family to live in a more affordable housing and to hopefully at some stage get on property market, buy my own house. And that looked like the decision for me. I think resilience is so important right now. I think climate resilience is a conversation we have constantly within our company, being resilient and doing what we do and advocating for the change we want to see in the world and talking to some of the biggest banks who haven't historically had the best climate strategies or climate policies or investments, and still a lot do invest in fossil fuel. And this is a transition for banks as it is for individuals and small businesses and everyone around the world. Everyone is hopefully on their climate journey, their sustainability journey. So we need to be resilient in everything that we do in regards to how we say fighting the good fight and waving the climate flag. So we need to be mentally resilient when we come up against these things. The people of Christchurch, as an example, have, yes, been very resilient and I think very strong, as you say, the last sort of 15 years or period of time they've gone through with the severe quakes here and unfortunately the mosque attacks. There is obviously significantly increasing climate disasters around the world and people, yes, need to be resilient. But I think it's just such a shame to be talking about resilience when we should and still should be putting more focus into preventing these disasters from happening. We should be trying to protect our people from needing to be resilient. This is the fact of the matter now. And it will continue to increase. So people will need to build this resilience and maintain this resilience that is very tough. I saw some article about just recently the increase of climate anxiety being searched on Google and people looking for support and looking for that. We are facing a lot of stresses and you can call it polycrisis as well. There's a mounting crisis on top of one another. So yes, our people need to be resilient, but I think without looking back at how we should have tried to stop or reduce these impact on our people, we need to look forward to what can we do now? What can we do today? How can we put our time and energy to use to protect ourselves and our people and our families and future generations from needing to be so resilient in the future? And I think that's why I get out of bed in the morning and hope many, many other people do in many other areas that are working towards climate and all different aspects of protecting our futures to hopefully lessen the need for that resilience for future generations.
Amelia Gaskell was on the podcast and she talked about her climate anxiety. She is the youngest podcast interviewee and she talked about her origin story getting into environmental science in her studies. She was talking about that she has this climate anxiety, which is so heart-wrenching and sad that people are living with something like that. Now, it's really interesting, this kind of prevention you are talking about, and that we need to look back and learning from the past to create a better future where resilience is not needed. I'm asking you what resilience means to you, because you also mentioned that Christchurch is building up again, but it's not building up to the previous levels, which means that they are learning from the past. As I understand resilience, it's bouncing back from the shock to the same level before the shock. And that's why I'm asking you, what does this resilience mean to you? Because as I understand, you are talking about more than just bouncing back to the original levels. You are talking about something different. And I don't know whether you have heard of the concept antifragility, which is learning from the shocks and the systems are not just not breaking, but also learning from the shocks and surviving and thriving based on those shocks. Have you heard of antifragility, or do you think that your resilience is a bit more than the usual kind of understanding of resilience?
Yeah, I love that That makes a lot of sense to me, and I think that is exactly what we need. I was definitely talking in terms of resilience in regards to not letting your normal self be affected, I suppose, by these constant waves of inaction or negative impacts to the cause. I love what you've just framed in regards to not only bouncing back to that normal, but also allowing you to thrive. In regards to, the climate anxiety piece, this is something that, many people, as I say, will deal with. And it's something that I've constantly been, internally, focusing or meditating on myself. And I think recently I looked at, like a lot of people, reading news, reading climate, I read a lot of climate books. And sometimes it can get very overwhelming. And sometimes I think there's something to be said about reading these articles and reading these books and understanding the problem. I think a few aspects. One would be that knowledge is power. And the more that you understand a problem or you understand the size of the problem, that you can be better equipped to deal with it. Knowing more is something to be said about something bigger than yourself as well. It really does take away the day-to-day problems or issues that you have. People talk about first world problems and small problems that you have in your daily life when you're looking at some of the catastrophes that are happening around the world. It does feel like it is the one big crisis, or the big crisis we as humanity are going to face, and it really pulls things into perspective. So I think there's some form of, I wouldn't say comfort, but better understanding of things in perspective. The other thing is, I think people working in climate need to understand that this is a validation of their life efforts as well, and their hours, by understanding the size of the problem dates the work that you're doing. And yes, it's scary and troublesome, and there's a lot of problems that are continuing to exacerbate, but it does validate the work that you're doing in this space. You know, you are fighting for the right cause, and it does continue to tell you that what you're doing is needed and to keep going. So I think there's some form of peace with reading these headlines. And when I receive bouts of anxiety, like many others do, I think some of those sort of points I can reflect back on help me to stay resilient. And as you say, yes, bounce back to normal, but also I love that thought of then using that to thrive and to inspire yourself to be motivated to do the next thing better for the cause.
The other interesting thing is this prevention. Do you think that climate change was preventable?
Yes, human-induced climate change. We've known about it for a long time, and we, as in people, entity, evidence that Big Oil and others have known about this since the 80s or earlier, and depending on some scientific studies. There's obviously planetary cycle changes, but the Anthropocene in regards to human-induced climate change and us now impacting our environment, then yes, could have been prevented.
My question is more about, did we have enough information to prevent it in the 80s or in the 90s? Because obviously it's human-induced, I'm not questioning that. It's just your experience with behavior change. Do you think that could have been prevented?
It's a big question, isn't it? Behavior change for individuals, they can only work with the information they receive. If that information doesn't come to them through misinformation or lack of information or miscredited factual information, that's a big part of it. So the people who did the studies, the companies, if they do not provide that information to the public, it's very hard for the public to act on that. I think the second thing is that behavior change is useful. And we can talk a lot more about this, the conversation, but you can only change within the system that you reside. And if those systems do not allow you to change in certain ways that you want, it is improbable for you to make those changes. Example would be transport. If I want to get from Christchurch to the top of the South Island, and I want to do that in a very low emissions way, very tough for me that we do not have light rail like big cities or countries globally. It's very hard to transport oneself with low emissions. Driving an electric vehicle is probably the best answer there. You would need to have stops for charging potentially along the way, unless you had a very nice, relatively currently expensive electric vehicle to get you there. Otherwise, you could bike if you had good enough legs and motivation, and that would take many hours. Otherwise, you fly. Other cities have the ability to take on some of those lower emissions. Then there's hitchhiking or car sharing. There's probably different people listening to this than coming up with ideas. Yeah, as an example, if you want to make changes, you're only able to do so within the system that you reside. So I think if the information came down earlier and was communicated well and accurately and credibly, and if the systems allowed people to make change and move away from fossil fuels earlier in the 80s, then yes, we could have made a significant difference. But I think those two big pieces, which were big business and government controlled, stopped us from being able to make that momentum and change that early on.
As a last question for this doom and gloom, what are your three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities?
My biggest fears, climate 1, 2, and 3. You need to, I think it's good we're doing it at the start so we can obviously turn into some of the positivity and some of the good things. I think you need to have that base level. Look, breaking down climate 1, 2, and 3, what I'd say, I think people being affected by climate events, as we're seeing all over the world, I think that's my number one concern. We joked at the start of the conversation about how cold it is in Melbourne right now. It's supposed to be summer. El Nino is coming. I fear for the wildfire in Australia this summer. You know, we're seeing more and more climate events, and I just concern for people being affected. And then I think the second would be the breakdown of ecosystems and habitat and species loss. Coming into Christmas, I've got a bunch of family and friends, like everyone, to give presents to. And this year, like I've done in the past, I will be buying people WWF vouchers for sponsorship of endangered species, adoption of species endangered for Christmas. So that's what they'll be receiving. That would be number two. And the third, I think, is just the further division between people. And we're seeing polarization of major parties in many countries. And I think misinformation is leading to a lot of that. I think those three would be the three biggest concerns I have.
I really liked your idea of Christmas presents being WWF vouchers. I did the same for last year, I think, that we offered to my sister, for example. She didn't have any idea what to get. And then, well, you are concerned about climate. How about we give the money I would spend on the present to an appropriate charity? And she was like, yay! So for future friends, someone listening to it, this could be a good option for presents.
Perfect. I like that.
And then, as you mentioned, let's switch from the concerns to the opportunities. What are your three biggest opportunities regarding the future of cities?
So I think the first one would be just responsible land and property development. When we're looking at these cities, and again, for instance, Christchurch, which is on the build back right now, just building back responsibly. Most of Christchurch, if you reflect back centuries, was formed on very soft land and from the ocean. And I think that was very apparent to many people, unfortunately, through the earthquakes. And a lot of people did not have that understanding. And potentially those that were building on the land had that inclination to know that that was a threat and a potential risk. And so I think as we develop more and all cities will grow and continue to do, I think responsible land and property development is a big opportunity, and we can turn that to a nice opportunity for gathering people and living in urban dwellings. I think sustainable energy has got to be the next one, all forms of green and renewable energy there. New Zealand is very fortunate to have a very high percentage of renewable energy. We're very lucky that the majority of our electricity, no matter which supplier, is very renewable. So that's fantastic. Australia, unfortunately, is very far behind that. It's still very coal dominated, and we need to move people from coal to renewable. And then from there, move people to solar, and then move people to electric vehicles and the like. So it is about sequencing these climate action in Australia. And I think banks and governments supporting this transition through funding have a significant opportunity in decarbonisation and the transition to play. We can talk a lot more about banking later on, their role in this. I think the third would be transport. Again, following that renewable grid, but being electrified and having a lot of sustainable mobility throughout these cities, bikes and cars to share, a nice public transport infrastructure, light rail for those that make sense. And yeah, looking at the roads we're building and unfortunately rebuilding after climate-related events, and seeing how we can do that better and put that spend into potentially these other areas. Responsible land and property development, and then a look at energy and transport. I think these are some of the areas that we have a significant opportunity to make a difference in our cities for the future.
And Christchurch also provides a really good example of comparing short-term resilience with long-term sustainability within these developments. Because after the first earthquake in 2010, they rebuilt everything as a resilient community. And then in 2011, the second earthquake said, nope, not here.
then they started to reframe their resilience on not just rebuilding, but okay, let's investigate what we can do for a longer term idea. So I really like this kind of sequencing you are talking about and investigating how to rebuild the things we have, we need to rebuild, or we have lost and want to create something better. Please explain to us, what do you mean by this kind of bank involvement? Because as a general assumption, banks don't project the picture that they really much care about climate. So please convince me otherwise.
So I think I'll start by saying everyone is on their journey, and hopefully that journey is ramping up. And this is a journey to decarbonize, live more sustainable, operate more sustainable, better for the future, lessen your impact on the world and people. And that is individuals, households, that is small business, enterprise, and banking in the sector. And so Kogo, the company I work for, is working with a number of banks in Australia. We work with CBA, Westpac, and Suncorp, and currently we have live deployments in those banking experiences for individuals. With the coverage that they have of individual customers across Australia, it's almost 40% of Australians have the ability, through the solutions we've built and provided through these banking apps, to see, measure, understand, and reduce their emissions through that banking experience. So that's, I think, the very first step, is that the banks have an opportunity to do this, to empower individual small businesses, their customers, with the ability to see the effect that their spending makes on the environment. We enrich transactional with carbon data, so they can actually see every purchase that they make and what is that equivalent to in a carbon sense. If I was to fly from Christchurch to Melbourne, what does that look like? If I was to drive and from here to top of the South Island, what does that look like? If I was to buy you a Christmas present, what does that look like? And I think these are the things that banks have the ability to do to empower their customers. And so that's the first step, and that's the measurement piece. The second piece is, once you've seen your carbon emissions, how do I then reduce? And we've talked about a few of these opportunities for a household or a small business in regards to moving to renewable energy, solar panels, electric vehicles. We're seeing banks all over the world come up with these sustainable loans or these green loans to help you afford these things. So they are funding your decarbonization. And there's some astronomical numbers being thrown around by these banks. Billions of dollars in the next years is standard for any bank. We're talking to banks all around the world. Bank of America, one of the big banks in the States, $1 trillion, and had chartered $400 billion of green loans to help their customers to decarbonize. They are starting to fund that transition and decarbonize that transition. I'm going to push investment in fossil fuels to the side and just talk about how they have the ability to, yes, fund the decarbonization of their customers, which is a significant portion of their emissions. If you're looking at a bank's operational emissions, 100 times that at least is their customer's emissions. So this is the sort of carbon elephant in the room. And we're seeing, even just the last 2 years, our solutions have been deployed. We're working with 20 banks around the world. Different markets are moving faster in this space, and banks are moving in this space. There is regulation coming, which is really helping, I think, as more solutions like these get deployed. Consumers will be demanding and asking for them, and banks will need to keep up or they will lose out on customers. There is a significant movement in this space right now, banks to fund this transition for small businesses and households who want to lessen their impact is the significant opportunity here, and we can only see that growing.
I will be the devil's advocate for a question and ask you whether this kind of measurement and showing the data to the customer, doesn't this put the responsibility on the customer and just on the customer?
This is a very good question, something that we discuss all the time. The first thing is, I believe, and we see the increasing trends every year, that individuals want to have access to this information. They simply don't have access to this information. Empowering them with the ability to do this, there's the age-old adage, what gets measured gets managed. You need to see what your opportunity is to reduce, where you need to reduce your hotspots. People do not know. I think your listeners, be very interesting to see how many of them have seen their own personal carbon footprint or understand how many tons a month or a year is their carbon emission and what is that breakdown between energy and transport and food. So I think people are asking for this. I think small businesses, they want to lessen their impact in the world. That small businesses are not wanting to make negative impacts on society, community, habitat loss, the likes. They want to be spending with suppliers that are being in effect in this way. I personally want to be on this journey. I enjoy doing what I can to reduce my impact for future generations, and that is an example there. We're also not saying that it is only on the individual. I think a big part of what we do is encourage the banks to obviously continue their own journey and to divest from fossil fuels and do all of the other things that they can, and be very open and clear with their customers on what they are doing. Everyone, as I say, is on that journey, and I think transparency is really important here about where they are as an organization and what they're doing. Another point is that we as a company, or me as an individual, are not saying that it is definitely only on the individual. I believe it's all hands on deck right now. Everyone needs to do everything that they can, and we need to have multiple solutions in multiple sectors approaching this gigantic problem in many different ways. And I think that is an approach that we hold true. This is possible. People are asking for it. Why should we not go down this path? It is not to discredit any of the large enterprise solutions or those people fighting in governments to make changes as well. These things all need to happen. I think everything needs to happen all at once for us to gain some traction. But a question that gets asked a lot, and it still comes out, will continue to come out on social media, in the news, when banks do continue to deploy solutions like this. But I think it is a conversation we all need to have. I think it's a conversation that is relevant. People talk about the best thing you can do for climate action is to talk about climate action and talk about what you are doing. Vocalize it, have the tricky, hard conversations with even family members, with everyone, so that it remains in the light and allows people to give their viewpoint and express their viewpoint and educate one another and gain insight.
When we talked about the behavior change, you also said that you can only change within the system you reside in. Do you think that this kind of information and the small actions can change the system itself?
Yeah, I think so. At a significant adoption comes to sort of principles of supply and demand, I would say, as individuals who are asking for more of something, then that becomes true. They get supplied more of what they want. Big business and small business and governments are looking at these trends. And if people are asking for more of these things, we talk about voting with your wallet or spending for the future. And I think every time you make a conscious, hopefully conscious decision to spend with a business, that is your vote for the future. You're giving a stamp of approval to continue doing what they're doing. Kogo has been around for a while, and we started as conscious consumers about 13 years ago. And that vision was to empower individuals to spend with businesses that had the same values aligned as them, or same values and principles as them. So not always being climate focused, but looking at B Corp and living wage and indigenous ownership, locally made, woman-led business, these things are important. Everyone has different value sets. And I think, again, this information is out there and people should be able to understand which of the businesses align to their values and allow them to spend with those businesses. And if you get that at scale, then those businesses who are doing the things that people want to see, paying their staff a living wage, taking action on plastics and animal cruelty free and all of these sorts of things, then those businesses will flower. And then those businesses that aren't doing those things will have two options. One is to improve and get better, or go out of business. And then you start changing economies once these solutions are at scale. So yeah, I think a big believer in collective action, making these changes. I was talking about obviously spending with business, but the same could be said for renewable energy company or transport. If a lot more people started taking public transport, well, what will they do? They'll pull more buses or run more trains. If more people move to renewable energy companies in Australia, then more energy companies will come up with renewable energy solutions, and more renewable energy companies will pop up. And as people move toward more solar, you can see the movement of EVs right now globally. Through the pandemic in New Zealand, so many electric bikes were purchased. The electric bikes, there's a shortage, they ran out. And I spoke to some owners who said they could have done 15 times the amount of sales if they had that content. There's definitely movement towards these things. I think if we got a lot of people on biking, then yeah, what would happen? We'd start building less roads, we'd start creating more cycle way. And then there's obviously flow-on effects of all of these things. Yes, I believe individual making these small changes can make a difference, but they need to be obviously multiplied. And I think that collective action is what we need to get to. And that's the scale, again, that bank and a lot of these large organizations can provide.
So it's not just that we get some responsibility, but we also have the power to influence the system, which is reassuring and invigorating and obviously, yes, threatening at the same time. But we can use our power to change the system. That's amazing. When you talk about emissions, what emissions are you talking about? Because, for example, Ellen Pierce talked about emission 1, 2, and 3 with direct, indirect, and general emissions. I would summarize it that, and I'm butchering his words. Please listen to that one. But what kind of emissions are you talking about when you talk about emissions?
It's a good question. Scope 1, Scope 2, Scope 3 sort of comes down to small businesses and their direct and indirect and upstream and downstream emissions. But in regards to, I suppose, what I've been talking about is the single carbon emission associated to any transaction for an individual or a household. Anytime you fill up your car, you have an electricity bill go out, there is an emissions attached to that spend. So Kogo does a spend-based carbon footprint, so we see the average emissions for that type of business in your country, and we multiply the transaction value by that emissions factor, and you do that across a number of transactions or all transactions for a month or a year, and that creates your carbon footprint as an individual. That is our approach. There's other approaches to creating a carbon footprint. Ours, again, is benefiting from transactional data that exists and can be done automated very fast, very easy, and be put into an experience like a banking app to allow individuals to understand it. I'm just referring to the general sense of a carbon emission associated to a transaction, so a spend-based carbon footprint.
Josh, you have been very generous with your time, and I am grateful that you entertain my questions, even with the ones that we get questions. What is your role in establishing the future of cities?
My personal role, I would like to say, supporting the just transition. My role is to encourage these banks to empower their customers with such solutions. So I lead conversations throughout Asia Pacific. Australia is moving very fast in this space. Singapore is moving very fast in this space. Hong Kong as well. My team in the UK and Europe are looking after the UN and things are moving very fast there as well. And having many conversations with many banks about the role that they can play to empower their business and household customers to understand and reduce their emissions is my role. And so our solutions are for the banks in one sense, but also for that end user as well. And so again, supporting the households and the small businesses to understand and reduce their emissions and be guided towards solutions that are available and credible and lower emissions. And we do have direct to small business solutions. So we have a partnership with Xero, the accounting vendor, and small businesses in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand can use that solution. It's the Xero experience. It's in the marketplace. It's an app called Kogo, and that's a free tool for them to use. So that is a direct to small business solution as well. So supporting banks to make these decisions to empower their customers, and then also have these conversations to, I suppose, individual and business owners to help them understand what they can do, trying to empower the understanding of what can be done to lessen your impact on the planet.
Thank you so much, Josh, for your work, because informing us what's in our power and what we can influence is very, very important. It's amazing that you are doing this with, again, banks who generally don't look like want to do something about this. But it's amazing that they really want to change something. Do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience?
I'm doing what I can and putting my skills or my experience to use in this space. And there's many people in our company who are a lot more educated than I in some of these areas and have put their longer life journey to the cause as well. I think that's it. We need multiple people with different skill sets, as we say, fighting the good fight and putting their remaining hours of work to use. That's what I endeavor to do. And you know, there are many people in our company, but many, many other companies and individuals and not-for-profits and organizations are all doing that as well. I think that's one of the things I would say is that continue to do what you do, think about what you care most about and put your hours to use. Think about what is that next action that you can take? What is that next thing that you can do to be more sustainable or to reduce your emissions? And socialize it and talk to others and have that hard conversation about what you're doing and what they could be doing and encourage them, support them. I think this is the ripple effect that will hopefully create the future that we want to see in the cities that we want to see around the world. And ask your bank, what are they doing to support you? Ask your bank to empower you and to empower your business or your household to be able to effectively, easily, credibly measure and reduce your emissions. As there is finance available, and if there isn't at your bank, change banks, move to that bank that is offering that opportunity to finance your decarbonization journey, because the money is available. That's, I suppose, what I would ask of any of the audience. And to those who are fighting the good fight, stay resilient and keep doing, because we need you to. It's, as I say, all hands on deck.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you so much.
It was really interesting to hear from Josh about the importance of individual actions, not to mention his acknowledgement of climate anxiety. Amelia Gaskell described her journey through this anxiety to find purpose in environmental sciences in episode 177. You can find out more about Josh online, all the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Josh's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the Future for Cities podcast?